A Beautiful Mind by Sylvia Nasser. Part 3. A Slow Fire Burning. Chapter 30. Olden Lane and Washington Square, 1956-57. Mathematical ideas originate in empirics, but once they are so conceived, the subject begins to live a peculiar life of its own, and is better compared to a creative one, governed almost entirely by aesthetical motivations. As a mathematical discipline travels, or after much abstract inbreeding, it is in danger of degeneration. Whenever this stage is reached, the only remedy seems to me to be the rejuvenating return to the source, the reinjection of more or less directly empirical ideas. John von Neumann. The Institute for Advanced Study, nestled on Princeton's fringes on what had been a farm, was a scholar's dream. It was bordered by woods and the Delaware Raritan Canal. Its lawns were immaculate, and one of its streets was Einstein Drive. It was also blessedly free of students. The atmosphere in the Fold Hall common room resembled that of a venerable men's club, with its newspaper racks and mingled scents of leather and pipe tobacco. Its doors were never locked, and its lights burned far into the night. In 1956, the Institute's permanent faculty were not many more than a dozen mathematicians and theoretical physicists. They were, however, outnumbered sixfold by a host of distinguished temporary visitors from around the globe, prompting Oppenheimer to call it an intellectual hotel. For young researchers, the Institute was a golden opportunity to escape the onerous demands of teaching and administration, and indeed the tasks of everyday life. Everything was provided the visitor: an apartment less than a few hundred yards from an office, an unending round of seminars, lectures, and for those so inclined, parties where the booze was plentiful, and where one could glimpse Lefschetz balancing a martini in an artificial hand, or witness a very drunk French mathematician displaying his mountaineering skills by rope climbing up and over the fireplace mantel. Some found the idyllic setting, carefully designed to remove all impediments to creativity, vaguely disquieting. Paul Cohen, a mathematician at Stanford University, remarked, "It was such a great place that you had to stay at least 2 years. It took 1 year just to learn how to work under such ideal conditions." By 1956, Einstein was dead, Gödel was no longer active, and von Neumann lay dying in Bethesda. Oppenheimer was still director, but much humbled by the McCarthyite inquisitions, and increasingly isolated. As one mathematician said, the Institute had become pure, very pure. Kathleen Morawetz, later president of the American Mathematical Society, put it more bluntly. The Institute was known to be about the dullest place you could find. By contrast, the current Institute of Mathematical Sciences at New York University was the national capital of applied mathematical analysis, as Fortune magazine was soon to inform its readers. Just a few years old and vibrant with energy, Current occupied a 19th-century loft less than a block to the east of Washington Square in a neighborhood that, despite the university's growing presence, was still dominated by small manufacturing concerns. Indeed, Current initially shared the premises, with its fire escapes and creaky old-fashioned freight elevator, with a number of hat factories. Financing for the Institute had come from the Atomic Energy Commission, which had been hunting for a home for its giant UNIVAC 4 computer. At the time, this great mass of vacuum tubes, with its armed guard, occupied 25 Waverly Place. The Institute was the creation of one of mathematics' great entrepreneurs, Richard Courant, a German-Jewish professor of mathematics who had been driven out of Göttingen in the mid-1930s by the Nazis. Short, rotund, autocratic, and irrepressible, Courant was famous for his fascination with the rich and powerful, his penchant for falling in love with his female assistants, and his unerring eye for young mathematical talent. When Courant arrived in 1937, New York University had no mathematics worth speaking of. Undaunted, Courant immediately set about raising funds. His own stellar reputation, the antisemitism of the American educational establishment, and New York's deep reservoir of talent enabled him to attract brilliant students, most of them New York City Jews, who were shut out of the Harvards and Princetons. The advent of World War II brought more money and more students, and by the mid-1950s, when the Institute was formally founded, it was already rivaling more established mathematical centers like Princeton and Cambridge. Its young stars included Peter Lax and his wife, Annalie, Kathleen Singh Morawitz, Jürgen Moser, and Louis Nirenberg. And among its stellar visitors were Lars Hormander, a future Fields medalist, and Shlomo Sternberg, who would soon move to Harvard. The Courant Institute was practically on Nash's doorstep, and given its lively atmosphere, it was not surprising that Nash was soon spending at least as much time there as at the Institute for Advanced Study. At first, Nash would stop by for an hour or two before driving down to Princeton, but he soon found himself staying the whole day. He never came too early, for he liked to sleep late after working into the wee hours at the university library. But he was almost always there for tea time in the lounge on the building's penultimate floor. As for the current crowd, a friendly, open group with little taste for the competitiveness of MIT or the snobbery of the Institute, it was happy to have him. Tilla Weinstein, a mathematician at Rutgers, who recalled that Nash liked to pace around on one of the building's fire escapes, said, "He was just a delight. There was a wit and humor about him that was thoroughly unstandard. There was a wonderful playful quality, a lightness." Kathleen Morawitz, the daughter of John Singh, Nash's professor at Carnegie, assumed Nash was just another postdoctoral fellow, and found him very charming, an attractive fellow, a lively conversationalist. Hormander recalled his first impressions. "He wore a serious expression, then he'd break out into a sudden smile. He was an enthusiast." Peter Lax, who had spent the war at Los Alamos, was interested in Nash's research and his own way of looking at things. At first, Nash seemed more interested in the political cataclysms of that fall. Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal, prompting an invasion by England, France, and Israel. The Russians crushed the Hungarian uprising, and Eisenhower and Stevenson were again battling for the presidency. Then in pursuing mathematical conversations. He'd be in the common room, one current visitor recalled, talking and talking of his views of the political situation. From the afternoon teas, I remember him as voicing very strong opinions on the Suez Crisis, which was going on at that time. Another mathematician remembered a similar conversation in the Institute dining room. When the British and their allies were trying to grab Suez and Eisenhower had not made his position unmistakably clear, if he ever did, one day at lunch, Nash started in on Suez. Of course, Nasser wasn't black, but he was dark enough for Nash. "What you have to do with these people is to take a firm hand, and then once they realize you mean it." The leading lights at Courant were very much at the forefront of rapid progress, stimulated by World War II, in certain kinds of differential equations that serve as mathematical models for an immense variety of physical phenomena involving some sort of change. By the mid-50s, as Fortune noted, mathematicians knew relatively simple routines for solving ordinary differential equations using computers, but there were no straightforward methods for solving most nonlinear partial differential equations that crop up when large or abrupt changes occur, such as equations that describe the aerodynamic shock waves produced when a jet accelerates past the speed of sound. In his 1958 obituary of von Neumann, who did important work in this field in the 30s, Stanislav Ulam called such systems of equations baffling analytically, saying that they defy even qualitative insights by present methods. As Nash was to write that same year, "The open problems in the area of nonlinear partial differential equations are very relevant to applied mathematics and science as a whole, perhaps more so than the open problems in any other area of mathematics, and this field seems poised for rapid development. It seems clear, however, that fresh methods must be employed." Nash, partly because of his contact with Wiener and perhaps his earlier interaction with Weinstein at Carnegie, was already interested in the problem of turbulence. Turbulence refers to the flow of gas or liquid over any uneven surface, like water rushing into a bay, heat or electrical charges traveling through metal, oil escaping from an underground pool, or clouds skimming over an air mass. It should be possible to model such motion mathematically, but it turns out to be extremely difficult. As Nash wrote, "Little is known about the existence, uniqueness, and smoothness of solutions of the general equations of flow for a viscous, compressible, and heat-conducting fluid. These are a nonlinear parabolic system of equations. An interest in these questions led us to undertake this work. It became clear that nothing could be done about the continuum description of general fluid flow without the ability to handle nonlinear parabolic equations, and that this in turn required an a priori estimate of continuity." It was Louis Nirenberg, a short, myopic, and sweet-natured young protege of Courant's, who handed Nash a major unsolved problem in the then fairly new field of nonlinear theory. Nirenberg, also in his 20s, and already a formidable analyst, found Nash a bit strange. He'd often seemed to have an internal smile, as if he was thinking of a private joke, as if he was laughing at a private joke that he never told anyone about. But he was extremely impressed with the technique Nash had invented for solving his embedding theorem, and sensed that Nash might be the man to crack an extremely difficult outstanding problem that had been open since the late 1930s. He recalled, "I worked in partial differential equations. I also worked in geometry. The problem had to do with certain kinds of inequalities associated with elliptic partial differential equations. The problem had been around in the field for some time, and a number of people had worked on it. Someone had obtained such estimates much earlier in the 1930s in two dimensions, but the problem was open for almost 30 years in higher dimensions." Nash began working on the problem almost as soon as Nirenberg suggested it, although he knocked on doors until he was satisfied that the problem was as important as Nirenberg claimed. Lax, who was one of those he consulted, commented recently, "In physics, everybody knows the most important problems. They're well-defined. Not so in mathematics. People are more introspective." For Nash, though, it had to be important in the opinion of others. Nash started coming to Nirenberg's office to discuss his progress, but it was weeks before Nirenberg got any real sense that Nash was getting anywhere. "We would meet often. Nash would say, 'I seem to need such and such an inequality. I think it's true that—'" Very often, Nash's speculations were far off the mark. He was sort of groping. He gave that impression. I wasn't very confident he was going to get through. Nirenberg sent Nash around to talk to Lars Hormander, a tall, steely Swede who was already one of the top scholars in the field. Precise, careful, and immensely knowledgeable, Hormander knew Nash by reputation, but reacted even more skeptically than Nirenberg. Nash had learned from Nirenberg the importance of extending the Holder estimates, known for second-order elliptic equations with two variables and irregular coefficients, to higher dimensions. Hormander recalled in 1997, "He came to see me several times. What did I think of such and such an inequality? At first his conjectures were obviously false. They were easy to disprove by known facts on constant coefficient operators. He was rather inexperienced in these matters. Nash did things from scratch without using standard techniques. He was always trying to extract problems from conversations with others. He had not the patience to study them." Nash continued to grope, but with more success. "After a couple more times," said Hormander, "he'd come up with things that were not so obviously wrong." By the spring, Nash was able to obtain basic existence, uniqueness, and continuity theorems, once again using novel methods of his own invention. He had a theory that difficult problems couldn't be attacked frontally. He approached the problem in an ingeniously roundabout manner, first transforming the nonlinear equations into linear equations, and then attacking these by nonlinear means. "It was a stroke of genius," said Lax, who followed the progress of Nash's research closely. "I've never seen that done. I've always kept it in mind, thinking maybe it will work in another circumstance." Nash's new result got far more immediate attention than his embedding theorem. It convinced Nirenberg, too, that Nash was a genius. Hormander's mentor at the University of Lund, Lars Gordian, a world-class specialist in partial differential equations, immediately declared, "You have to be a genius to do that." Courant made Nash a handsome job offer. NASA's reaction was a curious one. Kathleen Singh Morowitz recalled a long conversation with Nash, who couldn't make up his mind whether to accept the offer or to go back to MIT. He said he opted to go to MIT because of the tax advantage of living in Massachusetts as opposed to New York. Despite these successes, Nash was to look back on the year as one of cruel disappointment. In late spring, Nash discovered that a then obscure young Italian, Ennio Di Giorgi, had proven his continuity theorem a few months earlier. Paul Garabedian, a Stanford mathematician, was a naval attaché in London. It was an Office of Naval Research sinecure. In January 1957, Garabedian took a long car trip around Europe and looked up young mathematicians. "I saw some old-timers in Rome," he recalled. "It was a scene. You'd talk mathematics for half an hour, then you'd have lunch for 3 hours, then a siesta, then dinner." Nobody mentioned Di Giorgi. But in Naples, someone did, and Garabedian looked Di Giorgi up on his way back through Rome. "He was this bedraggled, skinny little starved-looking guy, but I found out he'd written this paper." Di Giorgi, who died in 1996, came from a very poor family in Lecce, in southern Italy. Later, he would become an idol to the younger generation. He had no life outside mathematics, no family of his own or other close relationships, and even later literally lived in his office. Despite occupying the most prestigious mathematical chair in Italy, he lived a life of ascetic poverty, completely devoted to his research, teaching, and as time went on, a growing preoccupation with mysticism that led him to attempt to prove the existence of God through mathematics. Di Giorgi's paper had been published in the most obscure journal imaginable, the Proceedings of a Regional Academy of Sciences. Garabedian proceeded to report Di Giorgi's results in the Office of Naval Research's European newsletter. Nash's own account, written after he had won the Nobel for his work in game theory, conveys the acute disappointment he felt. "I ran into some bad luck, since, without my being sufficiently informed on what other people were doing in the area, it happened that I was working in parallel with Ennio Di Giorgi of Pisa, Italy. And Di Giorgi was first, actually, to achieve the ascent of the summit of the figuratively described problem, at least for the particularly interesting case of elliptic equations." Nash's view was perhaps overly subjective. Mathematics is not an intramural sport, and as important as being first is, how one gets to one's destination is often as important as, if not more important than, the actual target. Nash's work was almost universally regarded as a major breakthrough, but this was not how Nash saw it. Giancarlo Rota, a graduate student at Yale who spent that year at Courant, recalled in 1994, "Well, when Nash learned about Di Giorgi, he was quite shocked. Some people even thought he cracked up because of that." When Di Giorgi came to Courant that summer and he and Nash met, Lack said later, "It was like Stanley meeting Livingstone." Nash left the Institute for Advanced Study on a fractious note. In early July, he apparently had a serious argument with Oppenheimer about quantum theory, serious enough at any rate to warrant a lengthy letter of apology from Nash to Oppenheimer, written around July 10, 1957. "First, please let me apologize for my manner of speaking when we discussed quantum theory recently. This manner is unjustifiably aggressive." After calling his own behavior unjustified, Nash nonetheless immediately justified it by calling "most physicists, also some mathematicians who have studied quantum theory, quite too dogmatic in their attitudes," complaining of their tendency to treat anyone with any sort of questioning attitude or a belief in hidden parameters as stupid, or at best a quite ignorant person. Nash's letter to Oppenheimer shows that before leaving New York, Nash had begun to think seriously of attempting to address Einstein's famous critique of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. "Now I am making a concentrated study of Heisenberg's original 1925 paper. This strikes me as a beautiful work, and I am amazed at the great difference between expositions of matrix mechanics, a difference which, from my viewpoint, seems definitely in favor of the original. I embarked on a project to revise quantum theory," Nash said in his 1996 Madrid lecture. "It was not a priori absurd for a non-physicist. Einstein had criticized the indeterminacy of the quantum mechanics of Heisenberg." He apparently had devoted what little time he spent at the Institute for Advanced Study that year talking with physicists and mathematicians about quantum theory. Whose brains he was picking is not clear. Freeman Dyson, Hans Levy, and Abraham Pius were in residence at least one of the terms. Nash's letter of apology to Oppenheimer provides the only record of what he was thinking at the time. Nash made his own agenda quite clear. To me, one of the best things about the Heisenberg paper is its restriction to the observable quantities, he wrote, adding that, I want to find a different and more satisfying underpicture of a non-observable reality. It was this attempt that Nash would blame decades later in a lecture to psychiatrists for triggering his mental illness, calling his attempt to resolve the contradictions in quantum theory on which he embarked in the summer of 1957, possibly overreaching and psychologically destabilizing. Chapter 31, The Bomb Factory. What's the matter with being a loner and innovative? Isn't that fine? But the lone genius has the same wishes as other people. If he were back in high school doing science projects, fine. But if he's too isolated and he's disappointed in something big, it's frightening. And fright can precipitate depression. Paul Howard, McLean Hospital. Jürgen Moser had joined the MIT faculty in the fall of 1957 and was living with his wife Gertrude and his stepson Richie in a tiny rented house to the west of Boston in Needham, near Wellesley College. Needham was then more exurb than suburb, still predominantly rural, a lovely place for walking, boating, and stargazing, of all of which Moser, a nature lover, was fond. That October and November, Moser would go outside every evening at dusk with the 11-year-old Richie, climb a great dirt mound behind their house, and wait for Sputnik, a tiny silvery dot reflecting the sun's last rays, to pass slowly over Boston. Having calculated the satellite's precise orbit, Moser always knew when it would appear on the horizon. Very often he would still be thinking of the afternoon's conversation with Nash. Nash drove out to Needham often. Despite their very different temperaments, Nash and Moser had great respect for each other. Moser, who thought Nash's implicit function theorem might be generalized and applied to celestial mechanics, was eager to learn more of Nash's thinking. Nash, in turn, was interested in Moser's ideas about nonlinear equations. Richard Emery recalled in 1996, I remember Nash being very much a part of our life. He used to come to the house and talk with Jürgen. They would walk and talk together and spend time in the study. The intensity of it was unimaginable. There could be no interruptions. An interruption was an absolute sin, a violation most serious. It was met with real wrath. When Jürgen and Nash met, it was very intense. I always had to be quiet. Returning to Cambridge in late summer, Nash and Alicia found an apartment with some difficulty. They each paid half the rent, for they had decided not to pool their funds. Alicia got a job as a physics researcher at Technical Operations, one of the small high-tech companies that were springing up along Route 128. She also enrolled in a course on quantum theory taught by J.C. Slater. They quickly settled into the pleasant, private, and social rituals of a newly married academic couple. Alicia almost never cooked. She would meet Nash on the campus after work. They would eat out with one or more of Nash's mathematics friends and often spend the evening at a lecture, concert, or some social gathering. Alicia made sure that they were always surrounded by amusing people, sometimes Nash's old graduate student friends, including Maddock and Bricker, sometimes Emma Duchesne, and whomever Emma happened to be dating, and increasingly other young couples like themselves, including the Mosers, the Minskys, Hartley Rogers and his wife Adrian, and Giancarlo Rota and his wife Terry. When they were with other people, Nash talked to the mathematicians, Alicia to the wives, or Emma. Yet her attention was always focused on Nash, what he was saying, how he looked, how others reacted to him. He too seemed always aware of her, even when he appeared to be ignoring her. That he wasn't especially nice to her, or generous, mattered less than that he was interesting and made things happen. Their friends accepted Nash's new status as a married man with more or less good grace. Some found Alicia ambitious, strong-willed. Others quite the opposite. Rogers recalled in 1996 that Alicia subordinated herself to John. She wasn't there to compete with him. She was totally dedicated to his support. Some of their acquaintances found their relationship oddly cool, but others came away with the impression that marriage suited Nash well, and that Alicia was having a good effect on him. Somehow he was relating a little better, Rogers recalled. Zipporah Levinson agreed. John was awkward. Alicia made him behave. Photographs of Alicia taken in those months show a radiant young woman. It was, as Alicia would say many years later, a very nice time of my life. Nash continued to work on the problem he had solved the previous year at Current. There were some small gaps in the proof, and the paper Nash had begun to write, laying out a full account of what he had done, was in very rough shape. It was, a colleague said in 1996, as if he were a composer and could hear the music, but he didn't know how to write it down, or exactly how to orchestrate it. As it turned out, it would take most of the year, and a collective effort, before the final product, which some mathematicians regard as Nash's most important work, was finally ready to be submitted to a journal. To complete it, Nash came as close as he ever had, or would, to an active collaboration with other mathematicians. It was like building the atom bomb, recalled Leonard Carlson, a young professor from the University of Uppsala who was visiting MIT that term. This was the beginning of nonlinear theory. It was very difficult. Nash knocked on doors, asked questions, speculated out loud, fished for ideas, and at the end of the day got a dozen or so mathematicians around Cambridge interested enough in his problem to drop their own research long enough to solve little pieces of his puzzle. It was kind of a factory, Carlson, who contributed a neat little theorem on entropy to Nash's paper, said. He wouldn't tell us what he was after, his grand design. It was amusing to watch how he got all these great egos to cooperate. Besides Moser and Carlson, Nash also turned to Eli Stein, now a professor of mathematics at Princeton University, but then an MIT instructor. He wasn't interested in what I was doing, recalled Stein. He'd say, "You're an analyst, you ought to be interested in this." Stein was intrigued by Nash's enthusiasm and his constant supply of ideas. He said, "We were like Yankees fans, getting together and talking about great games and great players. It was very emotional. Nash knew exactly what he wanted to do. With his great intuition, he saw that certain things ought to be true. He'd come into my office and say, 'This inequality must be true.' His arguments were plausible, but he didn't have proofs for the individual lemmas, building blocks for the main proof. He challenged Stein to prove the lemmas. 'You don't accept arguments based on plausibility,' said Stein in 1995. 'If you build an edifice based on one plausible proposition after another, the whole thing is liable to collapse after a few steps.' But somehow he knew it wouldn't. And it didn't." Nash's 30th year was thus looking very bright. He had scored a major success. He was adulated and lionized as never before. Fortune magazine was about to feature him as one of the brightest young stars of mathematics in an upcoming series on The New Math. And he had returned to Cambridge as a married man with a beautiful and adoring young wife. Yet his good fortune seemed at times only to highlight the gap between his ambitions and what he had achieved. If anything, he felt more frustrated and dissatisfied than ever. He had hoped for an appointment at Harvard or Princeton. As it was, he was not yet a full professor at MIT, nor did he have tenure. He had expected that his latest result, along with the offer from Current, would convince the department to award him both that winter. Getting these things after only 5 years would be unusual, but Nash felt that he deserved nothing less. But Martin had already made it clear to Nash that he was unwilling to put him up for promotion so soon. Nash's candidacy was controversial, Martin had told him, just as his initial appointment had been. A number of people in the department felt that he was a poor teacher and an even worse colleague. Martin felt Nash's case would be stronger once the full version of the parabolic equations paper appeared in print. Nash, however, was furious. Nash continued to brood over the DiGiorgi fiasco. The real blow of discovering that DiGiorgi had beaten him to the punch was to him not just having to share the credit for his monumental discovery, but his strong belief that the sudden appearance of a co-inventor would rob him of the thing he most coveted, a Fields Medal. 40 years later, after winning a Nobel, Nash referred in his autobiographical essay, in his typically elliptical fashion, to his dashed hopes. It seems conceivable that either DiGiorgi or Nash had failed in the attack on this problem, or a priori estimates of holder continuity, than that the lone climber reaching the peak would have been recognized with the mathematics field medal, which has traditionally been restricted to persons less than 40 years old. The next Fields Medal would be awarded in August 1958, and as everyone knew, the deliberations had long been underway. To understand how deep the disappointment was, one must know that the Fields Medal is the Nobel Prize of mathematics, the ultimate distinction that a mathematician can be granted by his peers, the trophy of trophies. There is no Nobel in mathematics, and mathematical discoveries, no matter how vital to Nobel disciplines, such as physics or economics, do not in themselves qualify for a Nobel. The Fields is, if anything, rarer than the Nobel. In the 50s and early 60s, it was awarded once every 4 years, and usually to just two recipients at a time. Nobels, by contrast, are awarded annually, with as many as three winners sharing each prize. Tradition demands that recipients of the Fields be under 40 years of age, a practice designed to honor the spirit of the prize charter, which stipulates that the purpose of the honor is to encourage young mathematicians and future work. The incentive, incidentally, is of an intangible variety, as the cash involved, in contrast to the Nobel, is negligible, a few $100s. Yet since the Fields is an instant ticket in mid-career to endowed chairs at top universities, ample research funds and star salaries, this seeming disadvantage is more apparent than real. The prize is administered by the International Mathematical Union, the same organization that organizes the quadrennial World Mathematical Congresses, and the selection of Fields medalists is, as one recent president of the organization put it, one of the most important tasks, one of the most taxing responsibilities. Like the Nobel deliberations, the field selection process is shrouded in great secrecy. The seven-member prize committee for the 1958 Fields Awards was headed by Heinz Hopf, the dapper, genial, cigar-smoking geometer from Zurich, who showed so much interest in Nash's embedding theorem, and included another prominent German mathematician, Kurt Friedrichs, formerly of Göttingen, and then at Courant. The deliberations got underway in late 1955 and were concluded early in 1958. The medalists were informed in strictest secrecy in May 1958 and actually awarded their medals at the Edinburgh Congress the following August. All prize deliberations involve elements of accident, the biggest one being the composition of the committee. As one mathematician who took part in a subsequent committee said, "People aren't universalists. They're horse trading." In 1958, there were a total of 36 nominees, as Hopf was to say in his award ceremony speech. But the hot contenders numbered no more than five or six. That year, the deliberations were unusually contentious, and the prizes, which ultimately went to René Thom, a topologist, and Klaus F. Roth, a number theorist, were awarded on a 4-3 vote. There were lots of politics in that prize, one person close to the deliberations said recently. Roth was a shoo-in. He had solved a fundamental problem in number theory that the most senior committee member, Carl Ludwig Siegel, had worked on early in his career. "It was a question of Thom versus Nash," said Moser, who heard reports of the deliberations from several of the participants. "Friedrichs fought very hard for Nash, but he didn't succeed," recalled Lax, who had been Friedrich's student and who heard Friedrich's account of the deliberations. "He was upset. As I look back, he should have insisted that a third prize be given." Chances are that Nash did not make the final round. His work on partial differential equations, of which Friedrichs would have been aware, was not yet published or properly vetted. He was an outsider, which one person close to the deliberations thought might have hurt him. Moser said, "Nash was somebody who didn't learn the stuff. He didn't care. He wasn't afraid of moving in and working on his own. That doesn't get looked at so positively by other people." Besides, there was no great urgency to recognize him at this juncture. He was just 29. No one could know, of course, that 1958 would be Nash's last chance. "By 1962, a Fields for Nash would have been out of the question," Moser said recently. "It would never have happened. I'm sure nobody even thought about him anymore." A measure of how badly Nash wanted to win the distinction conferred by such a prize is the extraordinary lengths to which he went to ensure that his paper would be eligible for the Booker Prize, the only award remotely comparable in terms of prestige to the Fields. The Booker is given by the American Mathematical Society only once every 5 years. It was due to be awarded in February 1959, which meant that the deliberations would take place in the latter part of 1958. Nash submitted his manuscript to Acta Mathematica, the Swedish mathematics journal, in the spring of 1958. It was a natural choice since Carlson was the editor and was convinced of the paper's great importance. Nash let Carlson know he wanted the paper published as quickly as possible and urged Carlson to give it to a referee who could vet the paper in a minimum of time. Carlson gave the manuscript to Hormander to referee. Hormander spent 2 months studying it, verified all the theorems, and urged Carlson to get it into print as quickly as possible. But as soon as Carlson informed Nash of the formal acceptance, which was in any case largely a foregone conclusion, Nash withdrew his paper. When the paper subsequently appeared in the fall issue of the American Journal of Mathematics, Hormander concluded that Nash had always intended to publish the paper there, since the Booker restricted eligible papers to those published in American journals, or worse, had submitted the paper to both journals, a clear-cut breach of professional ethics. It turned out that Nash had just wanted to get a letter of acceptance from ACTA to be able to get fast publication in the American Journal of Mathematics. Hormander was angry at what he felt was very improper and most unusual. It's possible, though, that Nash had simply submitted the paper to ACTA before learning that doing so would exclude it from consideration for the Booker, but that upon discovering this fact he was willing to antagonize Carlson and Hormander in order to preserve his eligibility. He may therefore not have used ACTA quite so unscrupulously, withdrawing the paper after it had been promised to ACTA and after it had been refereed would have been unprofessional, but not as clear a violation of ethics as Hormander's scenario suggests. However, it still showed how very much winning a prize meant to Nash. Chapter 32, Secrets, Summer 1958. It struck me that I knew everything. Everything was revealed to me. All the secrets of the world were mine during those spacious hours. Gerard Nerval. Nash turned 30 that June. For most people, 30 is simply the dividing line between youth and adulthood, but mathematicians consider their calling a young man's game, so 30 signals something far more gloomy. Looking back at this time in his life, Nash would refer to a sudden onset of anxiety, a fear that the best years of his creative life were over. What an irony that mathematicians who live so much more in their minds than most of humanity should feel so much more trapped by their bodies. An ambitious young mathematician watches the calendar with a sense of trepidation and foreboding equal to or greater than that of any model, actor, or athlete. The Mathematician's Apology by G. H. Hardy sets the standard for all laments of lost youth. Hardy wrote that he knew of no single piece of first-rate mathematics done by a mathematician over 50. But the age anxiety is most intense, mathematicians say, as 30 draws near. People say that for better or worse, you will probably do your best work by the time you are 30, said one genius. I tend to think that you are at your peak around 30. I'm not saying you won't equal it. I would like to think that you could, but I don't think you will ever do better. That's my gut feeling. Von Neumann used to say that the primary mathematical powers decline at about 26, after which the mathematician must rely on a certain more prosaic shrewdness. Compounding the irony is that the act of creating new mathematics, which appears so solitary from the outside, feels from the inside like an intramural competition, a race. One never forgets the crowded field, and one's relative standing vis-à-vis past and present competitors is what counts. Again, Hardy best conveyed what motivates many mathematicians, including himself. He wrote that he could not recall ever wanting to be anything but a mathematician, but also that he could not remember feeling any passion for mathematics as a boy. I wanted to beat other boys, and this seemed to be the way in which I could do so most decisively. More ambitious than most, Nash was also more age-conscious than most, or perhaps simply more frank about it. John was the most age-conscious person I've ever met, recalled Felix Browder in 1995. He would tell me every week my age relative to his and everybody else's. His determination to avoid the draft during the Korean War suggested not just a desire to avoid regimentation, but also an unwillingness to take time out of the race. The most successful are the most vulnerable to the feeling that time is running out. Such fears may be exaggerated, but they are quite capable of producing real crises, as the history of mathematics amply attests. Artin, for example, switched frantically from field to field trying to catch hold of something that would equal his early accomplishments. Steenrod slipped into a deep depression. When one of his students published a note on Steenrod's reduced powers, the reference was, of course, mathematical, not personal. Other mathematicians smirked and said, "Oh yes, Steenrod's reduced powers." Nash's 30th birthday produced a kind of cognitive dissonance. One can almost imagine a sniggering commentator inside Nash's head. What, 30 already, and still no prizes, no offer from Harvard, no tenure even? And you thought you were such a great mathematician, a genius, ha ha ha. Nash's mood was odd. Periods of gnawing self-doubt and dissatisfaction alternated with periods of heady anticipation. Nash had a distinct feeling that he was on the brink of some revelation. And it was this sense of anticipation as much as his fear, as he put it, of descending to a professional level of comparative mediocrity and routine publication, that spurred him to begin working on two great problems. Sometime during the spring of 1958, Nash had confided to Eli Stein that he had an idea of an idea about how to solve the Riemann hypothesis. That summer he wrote letters to Albert E. Ingham, Atlee Selberg, and other experts in number theory, sketching his idea and asking their opinion. He worked in his office in Building 2 for hours, night after night. Even when a genius makes such an announcement, the rational response is skepticism. The Riemann hypothesis is the holy grail of pure mathematics. "Whoever proves or disproves it will cover himself with glory," wrote E. T. Bell in 1939. "A decision one way or the other disposing of Riemann's conjecture would probably be of greater interest to mathematicians than a proof or disproof of Fermat's last theorem." Enrico Bombieri at the Institute for Advanced Study said, "The Riemann hypothesis is not just a problem, it is the problem. It is the most important problem in pure mathematics. It's an indication of something extremely deep and fundamental that we cannot grasp." Whole numbers that are evenly divisible only by themselves and one, so-called prime numbers, have exerted a fascination for mathematicians for 2,000 years or more. The Greek mathematician Euclid proved that there were infinitely many primes. The great European mathematicians of the 18th century, Euler, Legendre, and Gauss, began a quest still underway to estimate how many primes there are, given a whole number n less than n. And since 1859, a string of mathematical giants, G.H. Hardy, Norman Levinson, Atlee Selberg, Paul Cohen, and Bombieri, among others, have attempted unsuccessfully to prove the Riemann hypothesis. George Puglia once gave a young mathematician who had confided in him that he was working on the Riemann hypothesis a reprint of a faulty proof of the conjecture by a Göttingen mathematician who thought he'd solved the problem. "I think about it every day when I wake up in the morning," the young mathematician had said, and Puglia delivered the reprint the following morning with a note. "If you want to climb the Matterhorn, you might first wish to go to Zermatt, where those who have tried are buried." Before World War I, a German banker endowed a prize lodged in Göttingen for whoever proved or disproved the hypothesis. The prize was never awarded and indeed vanished in the inflation of the 1920s. Nash's first encounter with Georg Friedrich Bernhard Riemann and his famous conjecture took place when Nash was 14, probably lying on the den floor in front of the radio reading Bell's Men of Mathematics. Riemann, the sickly son of an impoverished Lutheran minister, was also 14 and preparing to follow in his father's footsteps, when a sympathetic headmaster who sensed that the boy was more suited to mathematics than the ministry gave him a copy of Legendre's Théorie des Nombres, to read. As Bell tells it, the young Riemann returned the 859-page work 6 days later, saying, "That is certainly a wonderful book. I have mastered it." This episode, which took place in 1840, was likely the origin of Riemann's lifelong interest in the riddle of prime numbers, and as Bell theorizes, Riemann's hypothesis may have originated in his later attempt to improve upon Legendre. In 1859, at the age of 33, Riemann wrote an 8-page paper, Über die Anzahl der Primzahlen unter einer gegebenen Größe, on the number of prime numbers under a given magnitude, in which he laid out his famous conjecture, one of the outstanding challenges, if not the outstanding challenge, of pure mathematics. Here is how Bell explains the conjecture. The problem concerned is to give a formula which will state how many primes there are less than any given number n. In attempting to solve this, Riemann was driven to an investigation of the infinite series 1 plus 1 over 2s plus 1 over 3s plus 1 over 4s plus, in which s is a complex number, say s equals u plus I times v, where I equals the square root of negative 1, where u and v are real numbers, so chosen that the series converges. With this proviso, the infinite series is a definite function of s. Say, zeta times s. The Greek zeta is always used to denote this function, which is called Riemann's zeta function. And as s varies, zeta times s continually takes on different values. For what values of s will zeta times s be zero? Riemann conjectured that all such values of s for which u lies between 0 and 1 are of the form 1 over 2 plus I times v, namely all have their real part equal to 1 over 2 to the 20th power. When Riemann died of tuberculosis at 39, he left behind a vast legacy, including the abstract four-dimensional geometry that Einstein would employ in formulating his general theory of relativity. Just as geographers had to go from two-dimensional plane geometry to three-dimensional solid geometry to create an undistorted map of the Earth, Einstein, to map the cosmos, went from three-dimensional to four-dimensional geometry. But it was for his tantalizing conjecture that Riemann is best remembered. Proving or disproving it would settle many extremely difficult questions in the theory of numbers and in some fields of analysis. As Bell put it, expert opinion favors the truth of the hypothesis. It is impossible to say how long Nash had been contemplating his own attempt, but it seems likely that his interest crystallized sometime toward the end of his year in New York. Jack Schwartz recalled conversations with Nash on the subject in the current Common Room. Jerome Neuwirth, a second-year graduate student at MIT in 1957-58, remembered that Nash had developed a very proprietary feeling about the problem around that time. Neuwirth recalled that Newman, perhaps to tease Nash, told Nash that Neuwirth, too, was working on the Riemann hypothesis. Nash came roaring into Neuwirth's office. "How dare you," he said. "What's a guy like you doing?" It quickly became a running joke. Every time Nash saw Neuwirth, he'd say, "Well, did you get anywhere yet?" And Neuwirth would answer, "Almost got it. I tell you about it, but I've got to run." As Stein recalled it, Nash's idea was to try to prove the hypothesis by logic, by internal consistency of the system. Some proofs are based on analogies, on rules of logic whereby something is proved indirectly. If one could show that the structure of two problems was in some sense identical, one could show that the logic of one proof had to apply to the other. It's a proof by logic, and it doesn't relate to the real context. It's not proving that one object is related to another object. Stein was dubious. He told me this very sketchy thing. It was an idea of an idea about how he was going to prove this thing. He was going to find another number system in which it was true. I thought, it's wild. It doesn't hang together. This struck me as simply unbelievable. This was as opposed to my earlier conversations with him about parabolic equations, which struck me as daring, but probably right. Richard Palais, a professor of mathematics at Brandeis University, recalls some particulars. Nash was considering so-called pseudo-prime sequences, i.e. increasing sequences, P1, P2, P3, of integers that have many of the same distribution properties as the sequence 2, 3, 5, 7 of prime numbers. For each of these, one can associate in a natural way a zeta function, which for the case of the true primes reduces to the Riemann zeta function. As I recall, Nash claimed to be able to show that for almost all of these pseudo-prime sequences, the corresponding zeta function satisfied the Riemann hypothesis. Bell warned that Riemann's hypothesis is not the sort of problem that can be attacked by elementary methods. It had already given rise to an extensive and thorny literature. By the time Nash turned to it seriously, that literature had grown several-fold. Both Ingham and Selberg, possibly others as well, warned Nash that his ideas had been tried before and hadn't led anywhere. Eugenio Calabi, who was in touch with Nash in this period, said, "For a person who is not a library hound, it's a very dangerous area to go into. If you have a flash of an idea with a scenario and think you may get a result, in the first flash of illumination you think you have a revelation. But that's very dangerous." There was, as Nash suggested, nothing absurd in his attempting to solve the outstanding problems in pure mathematics and theoretical physics. The skepticism with which his early formulations were greeted was, after all, merely a replay of the skepticism voiced by experts toward his earlier efforts, and has no doubt been exaggerated in hindsight. When those problems are solved, it will be by a young mathematician who attacks them with the hubris, originality, raw mental power, and sheer tenacity that Nash brought to bear on his greatest work. Yet the timing of Nash's decision to pursue these problems, just as he had turned 30 and while he was licking various wounds to what he would later call his merciless superego, suggests that a fear of failure lay behind his willingness to take unusual risks. Stein's impression of Nash during their conversations about the Riemann problem is interesting. "He was a little on the wild side. There was something exaggerated about his actions. There was a flamboyance in the way he talked. Mathematicians are usually more careful about what they will assert to be true." But of course hubris is not exactly uncommon. As Hormander, who went on to win a Fields Medal in 1962, put it, "It's part of life that not all things one works on work out. You overestimate your own abilities. After solving a big problem, nothing smaller is good enough. It's very dangerous." Later, quite possibly because of the effects of shock treatments, Nash had absolutely no recall of his attempt to solve Riemann's conjecture. But as it was, Nash's compulsion to scale this most difficult, most dangerous peak proved central to his undoing. There were other signs that Nash felt at that particular juncture a growing pressure to prove himself, as well as a newfound taste for taking risks. Nash had always been obsessed with money, even trivial amounts. Nash had made friends with Samuelson, Solow, and a number of other young economists at MIT. Samuelson recalled in 1996 that Nash told him about a bank with no checking charges at all. "Do they give you stamped self-addressed envelopes, too?" Samuelson shot back. Nash, who didn't get the joke, immediately replied, "No, do you know a bank that gives you stamped self-addressed envelopes?" Privately, Samuelson thought it was all a bit pathological. Norman Levinson, who complained to Samuelson about Nash's parsimony, apparently once told him to cut out his cheese-paring ways. Levinson said, "One extra theorem will earn you more than all that stuff." Not everyone thought it was weird. Nash was able to convince Martin and a few others in the math department to switch their accounts to the People's National Bank of Rocky Mount, Virginia, which charged no fees on checking accounts. That summer, Nash's somewhat compulsive attitude toward money blossomed into an obsession with the stock and bond markets. Solow recalled, "It seemed he had a notion that there might be a secret to the market. Not a conspiracy, but a theorem. Something that if you could only figure it out would let you beat the market. He would look at the financial pages and ask, 'Why is this happening? Why is that happening?' As if there had to be a reason for a stock to go up or down." Martin, the chairman of the mathematics department, also recalled that Nash liked to chat about the stock market. He had the idea you could get rich. Nash had some notion of arbitraging July 1999 bonds against September 1999, as well as various ideas about over-the-counter stocks. Solow was aghast to learn that Nash was investing his mother's savings. "I was horrified," he recalled. "That's something else," said Samuelson. "It's vanity. It's like claiming you can control the tides. It's a feeling that you can outwit nature. It's not uncommon among mathematicians. It's not just about money. It's me against the world. A lot of traders start that way. It's about proving yourself." In late July, against this backdrop of grand designs, the Nashes, who had not yet gone on a proper honeymoon, left Cambridge for Europe. They sailed from New York on the Île-de-France. Their ultimate destination was Edinburgh, where the World Congress of Mathematics was to take place in the second week of August. Nash was giving a lecture on nonlinear theory. Many colleagues from MIT and Princeton would be there, and Nash was able to pay for his trip partly out of Sloan funds. But first they went to Paris. There, having calculated that importing a used car from Europe was a bargain, Nash purchased an olive-green Mercedes 180 diesel. He and Alicia then drove south over the Pyrenees to Spain, back to Italy and up to Belgium. The trip was a success. "We were young," Alicia recalls. "It was fun." Another of his plans was to buy Alicia the diamond that he had promised her. Antwerp was the center of the world diamond market, and Nash had the idea that it would be advantageous to buy a stone directly from a wholesaler. Eli Stein's father had been a diamond merchant there before the war, and that is what may have given Nash the idea in the first place. If Nash had hoped for a bargain, he was disappointed. The yellow stone that he purchased was no cheaper than it would have been in the States, he recalled, in 1996. From Belgium, they drove to the North Sea, crossed over into Sweden, and visited Lund and Stockholm before crossing back to England. They rendezvoused with Felix and Eva Browder in London, and drove to Scotland with them. The men ignored the women who sat together in the back seat gossiping. At that time, Eva recalled, Nash wouldn't talk to women. On the second rainy day of the drive, Felix managed to dent the Mercedes, prompting Nash to repeat incessantly for the rest of the trip that, "This car has been browderized." There were, as Alicia later said, lots of famous people around. Nash seemed very much his usual self. He pouted a bit when Milner gave his invited half-hour lecture, a great honor. He got into a loud argument with Olga Ladyshenskaya from the University of St. Petersburg, an expert on a priori estimates of parabolic equations and the leading female mathematician of her generation. Nash was picking her brains, and she, somewhat paranoid, reacted rather violently. The Nashes held a party in their hotel room. Nash raised eyebrows by complaining at great length that Alicia took too long to get dressed and that she was always late. But he showed no emotion when, as he and Alicia sat in the balcony with the Browders, Moore, Milner, and others, the Fields Prizes were awarded. Chapter 33. Schemes. Fall 1958. The growing consciousness is a danger and a disease. Friedrich Nietzsche. The Nashes were back in Cambridge, and Nash was already teaching, when Alicia discovered, half with joy, half with dismay, that she was pregnant. Alicia, who liked her job and her paycheck, would have preferred to wait a few years. It had been Nash's wish that they start a family right away. He stopped short of saying that his desire for another child had been his motive for marrying, but he reminded Alicia often that the whole purpose of marriage was, in his view, to produce children. Now that his wish was to be realized, Nash was on the whole rather pleased, passing the great news on to Albert Tucker in a postscript to a letter in early October by referring to a new addition that we are expecting. He demanded that Alicia stop smoking. When she lit up at a math party, he told her to put out her cigarette, and made a scene after she refused. But otherwise all seemed to be well. Nash was teaching a graduate course. The course number, M711, a sly reference to craps, was Nash's idea, and helped draw enough students to fill a small amphitheater. Nash's first assignment also reflected his high spirits. He asked his students to invent a way to grade each other's papers so that he, Nash, wouldn't have to be bothered. Nash was at that moment preoccupied with his own future, and feeling increasingly restless. Martin had assured him that he was coming up for tenure that winter. The promise of a decision mollified him somewhat. Nash wrote to Tucker that the situation at MIT had reached a modus vivendi condition, which is an improvement over early 1958. But the sense that others were deciding his future oppressed him, and he was more convinced that he didn't belong at MIT. "I do not feel this is a good long-term position for me," he wrote to Tucker, saying that he was afraid of becoming isolated within the department, like Wiener. "I would rather be one of a smaller number of more nearly equal colleagues." His sister Martha recalled that he had no intention of staying at MIT. He wanted to go to Harvard because of the prestige.